She claims that stereotypes of women in books, in popular culture, in part shape how women will be. There is a whole long tradition of anti-feminism in the Middle Ages, and she claims that it has an effect on how women see themselves. This sounds like a very modern point. It's what the women's movement has called, and sociology, it's called socialization, how we learn to be ourselves.
A discussion of Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, next on Soundings.
The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Soundings is pleased to present a discussion about Geoffrey Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales with Professor Judith Furster. Dr. Furster teaches at Brandeis University and is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where her work has focused on interpretive studies of Chaucer's writing. Professor Furster, welcome to Soundings.
Thank you.
You specialize in studying Geoffrey Chaucer. You teach English. Could you give us just a brief account of Chaucer's life and times? People seem to know that name, but I suspect that many people really beyond the name don't know much at all.
Well, Chaucer was a fairly substantial man of affairs in the late 14th century. He was born into an important family of wine merchants. He was associated with royalty for most of his life. When he was very young, he was a squire in a royal household, the uncle of the king, and he then became associated with John of Gaunt, another uncle of the king, and later father of Henry IV.
Would you call him an aristocrat?
No. What you'd call him more is a middle-class person who was associated with royalty. So he spent a lot of time mediating between various social groups, and he was probably in the presence of people who outranked him a lot of the time.
What did he do for a living? How did he make his income?
Well, he was, I don't believe he was a merchant himself, but he had several important civil service jobs, including head of the wool customs in London.
He was a bureaucrat.
He was a bureaucrat, yes. And he was also a diplomat. He did some he did diplomatic missions for the king. He was involved in several missions to the continent. We're not sure about the exact nature of all of them, but we know he went abroad a number of times as a kind of negotiator.
Well, what would motivate Geoffrey Chaucer to become a writer?
Well, he seemed to be a great reader. He shows us pictures of himself reading in some of his works. And the traditional medieval mode of composition is to rewrite old works, rewrite old stories. So, you know, you might say that this is a kind of response to his reading, that he would criticize it, interpret it by writing his own versions, write it for himself.
What was he best known for during the time that he lived? His activities as a diplomat, or the fact that he was connected to a family that, as you say, mediated between commerce and culture, so to speak, or the fact that he had composed the Canterbury Tales? Was he widely known?
Hard to say. Certainly he was widely known among the educated class. He had friends at Oxford. He had associations with many of the poets of his day, both on the continent and in England. So certainly he was known as a poet and responded to in that way. He was well thought of, from what we can tell, from what people said about him, both in his own day and just after his death.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Canterbury Tales. Again, it's a kind of a commonplace in the language. But what are the Canterbury Tales? What briefly do they amount to?
Well, the Canterbury Tales are a group of tales that are all held together by a frame narrative about a pilgrimage. The narrator claims that he himself was going on a pilgrimage and met a group of other people who were taking the same journey to Canterbury to visit St. Thomas Becket.
And did this in fact happen to Chaucer?
Hard to say. Could have, maybe it didn't. Mm-hmm. Pilgrimages to Canterbury were certainly common, and we know he traveled a good bit. Maybe he did, but he doesn't have to have. He certainly might have met many of the kinds of people he says he met on this pilgrimage, because he was a merchant, because he knew the law, because he had been a soldier, because he had been a civil servant, and part of the royal entourage. He might have met many of the kinds of people he claims to have met on this pilgrimage, so it isn't that important whether he really went on this journey. It's a very rich bag of tales. Certainly there are themes that are woven throughout. Our problem with the work is that it's unfinished. It looks like the design at one point was to be larger than what we have. So it's hard to say that a theme develops in a certain way because we're not sure that we've got exactly the order.
So why should you read the Canterbury Tales? Why do you find them? You've devoted fair amount of time in your scholarly life, your professional life, to reading the Canterbury Tales. What's there that attracts you, that holds you?
A number of things. I suppose they're attractive for all the usual reasons that stories are attractive, and these are good stories. They're amusing and entertaining. They also are interesting historically. They are interesting because they are a kind of mirror of society in the late 13th century, which is an important time for our civilization. There's a tremendous variety of human experience portrayed in them. Some of them are funny, some of them are bawdy, some of them are sad, some of them are bitter or ironic. So there's a fairly rich range. I also find that the individual stories are very rich in human terms, and will pay back your attention. I have read them over a long span of time, and I've been reading them, say, for 10 or 12 years. And I find that whatever I learn about human behavior teaches me something new or allows me to see something new in the Canterbury Tales, so that they're very, they grow with you. But besides the fun and liking stories because of the human interest that we find in them, There are certain threads, certainly, that are interwoven all through the work.
And what would they be?
Themes like varieties of love, attitudes towards sex, the relationship between the individual and the society, sex roles, how power is distributed in a marriage, the issue of women and how much power they ought or ought not to have in the family is very important. Issues that are still alive for us today.
So these become, in effect, little sociological portraits.
You can take them as that if you want. Also, Chaucer was an intellectual poet. Although some of the stories are certainly wonderful stories, wonderful narratives, he also had a lot of intellectual interests. He was in touch with the philosophical debates that were going on at Oxford. And
debates about what?
Debates about the nature of the individual, debates about the way we are controlled by destiny or God, forces outside our control, debates about whether an individual's actions are determined by God or have in some way arisen from him himself. Issues like that were extremely important, not only for that day, but for what was going to happen to Western thought in the future. There are a few more things that make him important. He wrote the first iambic pentameter couplets in English, and that's a very important, that's become a very important prosodic form. People have also said that he was the originator of verisimilitude, that is a kind of realism through which he would create three-dimensional characters. So that I don't I think that's too simple, but he wasn't necessarily the first or the only. He didn't invent it. It was part of his time that people were getting more and more interested in this world and its details. But the tradition of realism is important to him, and he then contributes to it. He's also very good at dialogue, at creating speech that sounds like people really talking. He's also extremely interested in what goes on in the human mind. People have called him a poet of interiority, so that you're getting not only realism in portraying the world, how people look, how the world looks, but also how people feel, what they think about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's extremely important for the later development of literature, including the novel.
Professor Furster, could you give me an illustration from the Canterbury Tales, something that you've enjoyed reading that strikes you as a lot of fun, something to read not only for its ideas but for its characters, that would draw together all of these generalities that you've been mentioning about Chaucer as a writer and his interest in ideas, his knowledge of the way people behave?
There are many, but let's take one of the most famous. Probably one of his most well-known characters is the Wife of Bath. She tells a story in the Canterbury Tales about a knight who rapes a young maiden, and his punishment is to go out and find out what women want most in the world. He has a year to come up with the answer to this question.
And who's punishing him? Who?
The court. The king wants to kill him, but the women of the court commute his sentence to this.
Mm-hmm.
The women of the court commute his sentence to this riddle, which he must answer. So he goes out and spends a year, of course, fruitlessly getting a great variety of answers from women about what they want, and can't figure out what the right answer is, until he meets an old hag who says she will tell him the answer to the question if he promises to do whatever she asks later. So, of course, he says yes. She tells him that what women want most is mastery over their husbands. He goes back to the court. They say, yes, indeed, your life, you are now free, you have your life. And the hag comes along and says, well, it turns out what I want from you is for you to marry me, which he must then do. And when on their wedding night he tosses and turns unhappily in bed, she asks him what the trouble is, and he says, well, the only trouble is that you're old and ugly. And she says, oh, you're unhappy about that. Gives him a long speech about how it's not bad to be old, it's not bad to be ugly, it's not bad to be poor. She is all of those things because Christ was poor, and if she's old, she at least will be faithful, and, you know, lots of interest, good, pious talk. So she says, you can have me old and ugly until I die, but faithful to you, or beautiful, and you won't have any guarantees about whether or not I'll be faithful. He says, it's up to you. And she says, well then, I will be both beautiful and faithful. Now, Chaucer takes this traditional story, and first he enriches it with this sort of philosophical discourse on how possessions aren't everything, wealth isn't everything, which is a few sort of democratic sentiments thrown in. And then he puts it in the context of the personality of the Wife of Bath, which is part of the interest of the Canterbury Tales, because not only are you reading these nice stories, you're also reading the story of the telling of the story. And the Wife of Bath gives, as a prologue to this story, the story of her own life. So now we have not only the story of this transformation of the old hag, but the puzzle of, why does the wife tell this story? What's her interest in this? And of course, there are good clues about that. In her prologue, she says she's been married 5 times. She talks about how interested she is in sexuality, how interested she is in money, the relationship between sex and money, how interested she is in power. She claims to be interested in having power over her husbands.
National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
This edition of Soundings focuses on the writer who's been called the father of English poetry, Geoffrey Chaucer, in a conversation with Professor Judith Furster, who teaches at Brandeis University and who is a scholar at the National Humanities Center. Dr. Furster is a native of Cleveland, Ohio, that was educated at Smith College and Brown University. She's held postdoctoral fellowships at the University of Chicago and the University of California at Irvine in the School of Criticism and Theory. Professor Furster is the author of several articles on medieval literature, and she's a member of the Medieval Academy of America. The conversation resumes with Dr. Furster's comments about one of Chaucer's more memorable characters in the Canterbury Tales, the Wife of Bath.
Some people will say that he wrote this story to show the evils of women who are interested in money, sex, and power. Some people will take her as a personification of carnality, as a bad example, somebody we should not imitate at all. So that they will make her into a kind of allegory, that she is a representative figure mm-hmm. who means something, not necessarily a person. Other people find her a fascinating, rich, puzzling, intriguing person mm-hmm. who can be analyzed psychologically. Maybe we won't get a definitive answer, but we could try to figure out what makes her tick. We could be interested in the fact that she is proclaiming certain tenets about the rights of women. And they'd be much more interested in her as a personality, and then try to figure out what she could have seen, what she could have wanted in this story. Is it a wish fulfillment? She's now old. This hag transforms herself into a beautiful young girl. So is there some sort of wish fulfillment going on? Probably.
Professor Furster, it sounds to me like you're describing critical viewpoints, people who are imposing on the Wife of Bath women's liberation. They're bringing something to it in the 20th century that simply didn't exist in the 13th.
That's a big question. The rights of women, especially middle-class women, or the powers, if not rights, of those women, is hard to figure out, but she says about herself that she's a clothmaker. We know that there were clothmakers in that time and place, and they may have had a certain kind of economic power and freedom. Plus, the whole question of, as I said, the whole question of the power of women, especially in the context of families, what kind of power should they have vis-a-vis their husbands? Should they always obey? Should they sometimes make the decisions themselves? Very important, as far as we can tell.
Professor Furster, religion was a vital great force in the lives of medieval people. Was Chaucer preaching a lesson here? Was he echoing the doctrines of the Catholic Church, which dominated at that time? What?
Well, that's a good question, one that scholars have been puzzling over. Certainly, the Church dominated in the Middle Ages in a way it doesn't dominate now. There was only one church, and Chaucer was probably an Orthodox Catholic. There was nothing else to be. On the other hand, the church was much less monolithic than we think of it. There were enough arguments and debates within the church, there was enough change happening, there were enough discontinuities in the rate of change of different parts of the church, that you could be an Orthodox Catholic in a whole lot of different ways. For instance, when you talk about the wife's attitude towards sexuality, she is making an argument. She is a kind of preacher herself, and she's trying to make an argument for sexual enjoyment. She is not saying that sexuality is just for making children. She seems to have a certain enjoyment of it for its own sake. And there are some theologians or clerics in the 14th century who would say that sexual pleasure for its own sake is a bad thing. That is a very strict view that may not have been the only view. And we were talking about this before, the new interest in realism, portraying the world as it really is, is part of a very large change that includes the rediscovery of Aristotle and looks forward to modern empiricism. And the evaluation of sexual pleasure is right in there in that reevaluation of the worth of the whole natural world, so that you can see her as not an anomaly, as part of a larger change that was happening.
Professor Furster, who read this stuff? Who was Chaucer writing for?
Most immediately, he was writing for the court. He was also aiming at his poet friends, some of his philosopher friends. He's at a very interesting place in literary history, because books were getting to be more common. Paper was getting cheaper, it was getting easier to own books, and it's very likely that not only did he read his poetry out loud to the court, but he circulated it in manuscript.
Professor Furster, your work at the National Humanities Center deals with Chaucer's hermeneutics, or the hermeneutics of Chaucerian literature, which is to say, interpreting Chaucer. What is it that you're doing?
Well, I'm interested not only in interpreting Chaucer, because all Chaucer critics certainly are engaged in that activity. I'm also interested in what Chaucer might have thought about interpretation. Chaucer seems to have been engaged with the problems of interpretation and communication between people who are separate, people who cannot understand each other's experience from the inside. I mean, me and Chaucer, I mean you and me, people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of those questions are spoken to in Chaucer's work. He's very interested in people reading. He has people reading texts in some of his works. He's also interested in people reading the natural world. One work, he has a man walking through a garden and trying to figure the garden out. And he's very interested in people interpreting each other. So all of those things are analogs of each other. And he wants to look at the ways in which we impose ourselves on what we read, and now by read I mean interpret, so mm-hmm. I read you as a text when I interpret you, and very interested in the ways that what we read imposes itself on us. So there's a dialectical process going on in which we mutually influence mm-hmm. the other, whatever the other is.
Professor Furster, this is not the kind of thing that people walk around thinking about every day. How do I modify a text? How does a book modify me? How do I shape the world? Why is this important?
It's important because if we don't think about it, we fall into the traps of interpretation. Interpretation is a risky thing. Life consists of wrong, semi-wrong interpretations, correcting them.
Figuring out what somebody says to you.
Yes. If you are, I think Chaucer's hypothesis is that if we are somewhat aware of this kind of process, we will be somewhat protected, although we obviously can't be fully protected. We are somewhat protected from the dangers and the risks. And I think he was aware of the fact that when an audience takes the book and goes home, they are much less controlled by the author than if they're listening to the author read his works. If you read it out loud, the author controls the pace, the selections, the tone. He has gestures that will all guide the reader's interpretation toward what the author wants. The author won't control it because, as we know, you can mishear and misinterpret what you think you hear. But he has more control than if the audience goes away. I think Chaucer was worried about his effect on the solitary reader and the solitary reader's misreadings of him.
Professor Furster, how would this business of reading between the lines and modifying the lines and having the lines shape the reader, how does that apply to what you've said about the wife of Bath?
In a number of ways. First of all, she herself is a great reader. She is an exegete herself, that is, an interpreter of texts. She hauls out all kinds of texts in order to make her argument. She argues with the Bible, using the Bible. She talks about Saint. She attacks Saint Jerome, and so she herself is very textual. But what's more, she claims to be partly a creation of texts. She claims that stereotypes of women in books, in popular culture, in part shape how women will be. She claims that she has been seen through these stereotypes, and she partly is what she is because women have been spoken of in this way. There is a whole long tradition of anti-feminism in the Middle Ages. And she claims that it has an effect on how women see themselves. This sounds like a very modern point. It's what the women's movement has called, sociology, it's called socialization, how we learn to be ourselves. But I think that's the point she's making. And one of the places you can see that most, not only in her use of texts, in her own arguments, but her fifth husband, whom she claims to have loved very much, had a book, an anti-feminist tract, out of which he used to read to her at night. And there's some implication that she would have preferred other nighttime activities to being read to out of an anti-feminist book. So she, in a way, she claims to be a creation of this book. She doesn't like being perceived through it. At the end of her prologue, she recounts how she attacked the book, mm-hmm. tore pages out of it, and at the end of her argument with her husband, the book ends up in the fire. So she is examining the ways in which, in this instance her husband, but more generally people, have learned to see women through the literary tradition by using the stereotypes as lenses, mm-hmm. which distort, she would say, or their perceptions of women. And she's also interested in the ways in which women have been shaped by the way they are seen. So both sides of the process.
Mm-hmm. It might be easy to say, Professor Furster, that you work for Ms. Magazine. Have you been accused of bringing to the Canterbury Tales a perspective that isn't really there?
This issue is there. I might plausibly be accused of working for Ms. Magazine, but I don't think Chaucer could have. I know it sounds contemporary. He even has the wife of Bath say at one point, "Of course all the stories make women look bad. They're written by men." That sounds like a very modern point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certainly interested in the feminist issue, as I think Chaucer was, to have spent his time and energy and made one of his best characters out of it. But I'm also interested in the more philosophical issue about interpretation and the effect that interpretation has in people's lives.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me for Soundings. This week the topic is Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, seen from a feminist literary perspective. A conversation with Professor Judith Furster of Brandeis University. I hope you'll listen for Soundings.